All right, so this is part six of A Bondage of the Will, a display of the forces on Luther's side. We've come to the last part of this book, in which we promised we must produce our forces against free choice. But we should not produce all of them, for who could do that in one small book, when the whole of Scripture, every jot and tittle of it, is on our side? Nor is it necessary, on the one hand, because free choice is already vanquished and prostrate by a twofold conquest. Once, where we prove that everything Diotrephe or Erasmus thought to be in its favor is actually against it, and again, where we show that the arguments she sought to refute still stand invincible. On the other hand, even if free choice were not already vanquished, no more than a couple of missiles would be required to lay it low, and that would be enough. For what need is there, when an enemy has been killed by any one shot, to riddle his dead body with a lot more? Now, therefore, we shall be as brief as the subject will allow, and out of our numerous armies we will bring forward two high commanders with a few of their battalions, namely Paul and John the Evangelist. St. Paul, universal sinfulness nullifies free choice. This is how Paul, writing to the Romans, enters into an argument against free choice and for the grace of God. Quote, "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men who in wickedness hold back the truth of God." Unquote. Romans chapter 1, verse 18. Do you hear in this the general verdict of all men, that they are under the wrath of God? What else does this mean but that they are deserving of wrath and punishment? He gives as the reason for the wrath the fact that they do nothing but what deserves wrath and punishment, because they are all ungodly and wicked, and in wickedness hold back the truth. Where now is the power of free choice to attempt anything good? Paul represents it as deserving the wrath of God and pronounces it ungodly and wicked. And that which deserves wrath and is ungodly strives and prevails against grace, not for grace. There will be smiles here at sleepy old Luther, who has not looked carefully enough at Paul, and someone will say that Paul is not there speaking about all men, nor about all their doings, but only about the ungodly and wicked, and, as is expressly stated, those who in wickedness hold back the truth, so that it does not follow that all men are like that. To this I reply that for Paul it makes no difference whether you say, quote, "against all ungodliness of men," unquote, or "against the ungodliness of all men," unquote. For Paul almost everywhere uses Hebraisms, so that the meaning is, quote, "all men are ungodly and wicked, and in their wickedness they suppress the truth, hence they are all deserving of wrath," unquote. Furthermore, in the Greek, there is no relative, quote, "of men who," unquote, but an article like this: "The wrath of God is revealed against all ungodliness and wickedness of men, and the suppressors of the truth in wickedness," so that the clause translated, "who in wickedness hold back the truth," is, as it were, adjectival to all men. Just as the relative clause is adjectival in our Father who art in heaven, for which an alternative reading would be our Heavenly Father, or our Father in heaven. The objection, on the other hand, is designed to separate out those who believe and are godly. But all this would be a mere empty talk, were it not so compellingly confirmed by the drift of Paul's argument itself. For shortly before, he has said, quote, "The gospel is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek." Romans chapter 1, verse 16. Here are no obscure or ambiguous words, quote, "to Jews and Greeks," unquote, means that to all men, the gospel of the power of God is necessary in order that they may have faith and be saved from the wrath that is revealed. I ask you, when he declares that the Jews, rich as they are in righteousness, the law of God, and the power of free choice, are without distinction destitute and in need of the power of God to save them from the wrath that is revealed, and when he makes this power necessary for them, does he not deem them to be under wrath? What men will you pick out, then, as not liable to the wrath of God, when you are obliged to believe that the finest men in the world, the Jews and the Greeks, were in that condition? Again, what exceptions will you make among the Jews and the Greeks themselves when Paul, without any distinction, puts them all into one category and brings them all under the same judgment? Must we suppose that among these two most distinguished peoples, that there were not any who aspired to virtue? Did none of them strive with all their might of their free choice? But Paul pays no attention to this. He puts them all under wrath, declares them all ungodly and wicked. And must we not believe that in similar terms the rest of the apostles, each in his own sphere, consigned all the other nations also to this wrath? This passage of Paul's, therefore, stands unyielding in its insistence that free choice, or the most excellent thing in men, even the most excellent men, who were possessed of the law, righteousness, wisdom, and all the virtues, is ungodly, wicked, and deserving the wrath of God. Otherwise, Paul's whole argument is valueless. But if it is not, then the division he makes leaves no one on neutral ground when he assigns salvation to those who believe in the gospel and wrath to all the rest, or takes believers as righteous and unbelievers as ungodly, wicked, and subject to wrath. For what he means is this: the righteousness of God is revealed in the gospel as being of faith, so it follows that all men are ungodly and wicked. For it would be foolish of God to reveal righteousness to men if they either knew it already or possessed the seeds of it. But seeing that God is not foolish, and yet he reveals to them the righteousness of salvation, it is evident that free choice, even in the highest type of men, neither possesses nor is capable of anything, and does not even know what is righteous in the sight of God, unless perhaps the righteousness of God is not revealed to the highest type, but only to the lowest, despite Paul's boasting that he is under obligation both to Jews and Greeks, wise and foolish, barbarians and Greeks. Romans chapter 1, verse 14. Therefore, Paul in this passage lumps all men together in a single mass and concludes that, so far from being able to will or do anything good, they are all ungodly, wicked, and ignorant of righteousness and faith. And this conclusion indisputably follows from the fact that God reveals to them, as ignorant and sitting in darkness, the righteousness of salvation. For this means that in themselves they are ignorant, and being ignorant of the righteousness of salvation, they are certainly under wrath and damnation, from which, in their ignorance, they can neither extricate themselves nor even try to. For how can you try if you do not know what there is to try about, or how, why, and wherefore to try? With this conclusion, plain fact and experience agree. For show me anyone in the whole race of mortals, even if he is the holiest and most righteous of them all, to whom it has ever occurred that the way to righteousness and salvation is the way of faith in one who is both God and man, who for the sins of men both died and rose again and is seated at the right hand of the Father. Or show me any who has even dreamed of this wrath of God, which Paul here says is revealed from heaven. Look at the greatest philosophers. What have been their thoughts about God, and what have they left in their writings about the wrath to come? Look at the Jews, constantly instructed by so many signs, so many prophets. What do they think of this way? Not only have they not accepted it, but they so hate it that no nation under heaven has more fiercely persecuted Christ down to the present day. But who would venture to say that among so great a people there was not one who cultivated his free choice and endeavored all he could by its power? How is it then that they all endeavor in the opposite direction, and that the most excellent thing and the most excellent men has not only not followed this method of righteousness, and has not only been ignorant of it, but since it has been published and revealed, has actually rejected it with the greatest hatred and sought to destroy it? So much so that Paul, in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 23, says that this way is a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. Now, whereas he names Jews and Gentiles without distinction, and it is certain that the Jews and Gentiles were the principal peoples under heaven, it is at the same time certain that free choice is nothing else but the supreme enemy of righteousness and man's salvation. Since there must have been at least a few among the Jews and Gentiles who toiled and strove to the utmost of the power of free choice, yet just by doing so, they did nothing but wage war against grace. Now go and say that free choice inclines toward the good, when goodness and righteousness themselves are a stumbling block and foolishness to it. And you say, and you cannot say that it applies to some, but not to all. For Paul speaks of all without distinction when he says, quote, to Gentiles folly and to Jews a stumbling block, unquote, and accepts none but believers. To us, he says, meaning those who are called and saints in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 2, it is, quote, the power and wisdom of God, unquote, 1 Corinthians 1:18. He does not say to some Gentiles and some Jews, but simply to Gentiles and Jews who are not of us. And thus he separates believers from unbelievers by a clear line of division, leaving no one in between. But we are discussing the Gentiles as they act apart from grace, and it is these to whom Paul says the righteousness of God is folly that they abhor. So much for the laudable endeavor of free choice toward the good. Consider, moreover, whether Paul himself is not citing the most outstanding among the Greeks when he says it was the wiser among them who became fools and whose minds were darkened, or who became futile in their reasonings, that is, in their subtle disputations, Romans chapter 1, verse 21 and following. Tell me, does he not here touch the sublimest achievement of Greek humanity, their reasonings? For this means their best and loftiest ideas and opinions, which they regarded as solid wisdom. But this wisdom, which he elsewhere calls foolish, 1 Corinthians 1:21, here he calls futile, as having succeeded by its many endeavors only in becoming worse, so that at length, with darkened minds, they worshipped idols and perpetrated the consequent enormities which he records. If, therefore, the noblest effort and achievement of the noblest of the Gentiles is evil and ungodly, what must we think of the rest? The common herd, or the lower orders, so to say, of the Gentiles. For even here, among the noblest, he makes no distinction, but condemns their devotion to wisdom without any respect of persons. And when the achievement or the attempt at it is itself condemned, then all who devote themselves to it are condemned, even though they exercise the utmost power of free choice in doing so. Their very best endeavor itself, I say, is asserted to be vicious. So how much more those who engage in it? In a similar way, he goes on to reject without any distinction the Jews who are literally but not spiritually Jews, Romans chapter 2, verse 29. You, he says, with the letter and circumcision dishonor God, verse 27. Also, for he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly, verse 28 and following. What could be plainer than this division? The outward Jew is a transgressor of the law. Yet, how many Jews do you think there were who, though not having faith, were most wise, religious, and virtuous men, and men who strove with might and main to attain to righteousness and truth? Why, he frequently bears them testimony that they have a zeal for God, Romans 10:2, that they pursue the righteousness of the law, Romans 9:31, that they earnestly seek night and day to attain to salvation, Acts chapter 26, verse 7, that they live blamelessly, see Philippians chapter 3, verse 6. Even so, they are transgressors of the law because they are not Jews spiritually, and they stubbornly resist the righteousness of faith. What then remains but that free choice is worst when it is best, and the more it endeavors, the worse it becomes and behaves. The words are plain, the division is certain, there is nothing to contradict it. But let us hear Paul himself as his own interpreter. In the third chapter, in a sort of peroration, he says, what then? Are we better off than they? Not at all, for we have argued that Jews and Greeks are all under sin. Romans chapter 3, verse 9. Where is free decision now? All, he says, all Jews and Greeks are under sin. Are there any tropes or knots here? Now, what is the world's interpretation worth in face of this clear as possible statement? When he says all, he accepts none. But when he declares that they are under sin, or in other words, are slaves of sin, he leaves nothing of good in them. But where he has stated this case, that Jews and Gentiles are all under sin, nowhere but the place we have shown, where he says, quote, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men. Romans chapter 1, verse 18. And he goes on to prove this from experience, pointing out that in God's displeasure, they have been given up to so many vices as though these fruits of their own ungodliness convict them of willing and doing nothing but evil. Then he judges the Jews separately when he says that the Jew, according to the letter, is a transgressor, and proves this similarly by fruits and experience, saying, quote, you preach against stealing, yet you steal. You abhor idols, yet you commit sacrilege. Romans chapter 2, verse 21 and following. And he accepts none at all but those who are Jews according to the Spirit. See Romans chapter 9, verse 6, and Galatians chapter 4, verse 22. Nor can you get away from this by saying that although they are under sin, yet what is best in them, such as their reason and will, has a bias toward the good. For if a good tendency remains, it is false when he says that they are under sin. For when he names Jews and Gentiles, he includes everything there is in Gentiles and Jews, unless you are going to turn Paul upside down and insist that he wrote, quote, the flesh of all Jews and Gentiles, that is to say their lower passions, are under sin, unquote. But the wrath that is revealed from heaven against them is going to damn their whole being, unless they are justified through the Spirit, and that would not be the case if they were not with their whole being under sin. However, let us see how Paul proves this point from Holy Writ, and whether, quote, the words have more polemic force in Paul than in their own context, unquote. As it is written, he says, none is righteous, no, not one, no one understands, no one seeks for God, all have turned aside, together they have become worthless, no one does good, not even one, and so forth. Romans chapter 3, verse 10 and following. Here, give me a suitable interpretation if you can. Invent tropes, allege that the words are obscure and ambiguous, and defend free choice against these damning sentences if you dare. Then I too will willingly yield and recant, and will myself be a confessor and asserter of free choice. It is certain that these things are said of all men, for the prophet represents God as looking down on all men and passing this judgment on them. For so it says in Psalm chapter 13, actually it's chapter 14, verse 2, quote, the Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any that understand or that seek after God, but they have all gone astray, etc. And lest the Jews should think that this did not apply to them, Paul forestalls them with the assertion that it applies above all to them. Quote, we know, he says, that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law. Romans 3:19. He meant just the same where he said, quote, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Romans 2:9. You hear, therefore, that all the children of men, all who are under the law, Gentiles and Jews alike, come under this judgment in the sight of God, that not even one of them is righteous, understands, or seeks after God, but all have turned aside and become worthless. Now, I imagine that among the children of men and those who are under the law, there are included also the best and noblest of them who by the power of free choice strive after virtue and good, concerning whom diatribe, Erasmus, loudly proclaims that they have an awareness of the good and certain seeds of virtue implanted in them, unless perhaps she maintains that they are children of angels. How then can they strive after the good, when they are totally ignorant of God, and neither seek after God nor pay any regard to Him? How can they have a power worth anything as a means to the good, when they have all turned aside from the good and are altogether worthless? Are we ignorant of what it means to be ignorant of God, or not understand, not to seek after God, not to fear God, to turn aside and become worthless? Are not the words entirely clear, and do they not teach us just this, that all men are devoid of the knowledge of God and full of contempt for Him, and they all turn aside to evil and are worthless as regards the good? For it is not a question here of ignorance about where to find food or of contempt for money, but of ignorance and contempt for religion and godliness. And such ignorance and contempt are beyond doubt not in the flesh and the lower and grosser passions, but in the highest and most excellent powers of men, in which there ought to reign righteousness and godliness, the knowledge of God and and reverence for God. In other words, they are in reason and the will, and therefore in the power of free choice itself, or in the very seeds of virtue and the most excellent thing there is in a man. Where are you now, friend Diatribe, with the promise you gave earlier that you would willingly agree that the most excellent thing in man is flesh, in other words, ungodly, if this were proved from the Scriptures? Agree now, then, when you hear that the most excellent thing in all men is not only ungodly, but ignorant of God, and contemptuous of God, inclined to evil and worthless as regards the good. For what does it mean to be wicked but that the will, which is one of the most excellent things, is wicked? What does it mean to be without understanding of God and the good but that reason, which is another of the most excellent things, is ignorant of God and the good, or is blind to the knowledge of godliness? What does it mean to turn aside and become worthless, but that men have simply no ability in any part of themselves, and least of all in their most excellent parts, to turn to the good, but only to evil? What does it mean not to fear God, but that in all their parts, and especially the higher ones, men are despisers of God? But to be despisers of God is to be at the same time despisers of all the things of God, his words, works, laws, precepts, and will, for example. What now can reason dictate that is right when it is itself blind and ignorant? What can the will choose that is good when it itself is evil and worthless? Or rather, what choice has the will when reason dictates to it only the darkness of its own blind ignorance? With reason in error, then, and the will misdirected, what can man do or attempt that is good? But someone will perhaps venture the sophistry that although the will goes astray and reason is ignorant, in actual fact, yet it is inherently possible for the will to make some attempt at the good and for reason to know something of the right, since there are many things that we can do which we do not do. And after all, we are discussing here what is possible, not what actually happens. I reply that the words of the prophet include both actuality and potentiality. And to say that a man does not seek for God is the same as saying that he cannot seek for God. You may gather this from the fact that if there were a power or ability in man to will good, then since no inaction or idleness is permitted by the motion of divine omnipotence, as we have shown above, it would be impossible for it to avoid being set in motion and, at least in one instance, if not more, displayed in some employment. But this is not what happens. For God looks down from heaven and does not see even one who seeks or attempts to seek him. Hence it follows that there is nowhere any power which might attempt or wish to seek him, but instead they all turn aside. Besides, if Paul were not understood as implying man's impotence, his argument would lose its point, for his whole concern here is to make grace necessary for all men. But if they were able to initiate anything of themselves, there would be no need of grace. As it is, however, they are not able, and therefore they do need grace. So you see that free choice is completely abolished by this passage, and nothing good or virtuous is left in man, since he is flatly stated to be unrighteous, ignorant of God, despiser of God, turned aside from him, and worthless in the sight of God. The prophet's words are weighty enough, and not less in their own context than in Paul's quotation of them. It is no small matter to say that man is ignorant of God and despises God, for these are the sources of all crimes, the sink of all sins, nay, the hell of all evils. Could any evil not be there where there is ignorance and contempt of God? In short, the reign of Satan in men could not have been described in fewer or more expressive terms than by his saying that they are ignorant of God and despisers of God. That betokens unbelief. It betokens disobedience, sacrilege, and blasphemy toward God. It betokens cruelty and lack of mercy toward our neighbor. It betokens love of self in all things, love of self in all things of God and men. There you have a picture of the glory and power of free choice. However, Paul goes on to state explicitly that he is speaking of all men, and especially of the best and noblest among them, when he says, quote, "So that every mouth may be stopped, and the whole world may be held accountable to God. For no human being will be justified in his sight by works of the law." Romans 3:19 and following. Tell me, how can every mouth be stopped if there still remains a power by which we can do something? And for we shall be able to say to God, quote, "There is not absolutely nothing here. There is something you cannot condemn, a measure of ability you yourself have given. This at least will not be silenced and will not be accountable to you," unquote. For if the power of free choice is sound and valid, it is not true that the whole world is accountable and guilty before God. For that power is no insignificant affair in an insignificant part of the world, but most conspicuous and most common throughout the whole world, and its mouth ought to be stopped, or else if its mouth ought to be stopped, it must be accountable to God and guilty together with the whole world. But by what right can it be said to be guilty unless it is unrighteous and ungodly, or in other words, deserving of punishment and retribution? Show me, please, by what interpretation this power of man can be absolved of the guilt with which the whole world is charged before God, or by what device it can be exempted from inclusion in the whole world. These words of Paul, quote, "All have turned aside. The whole world is guilty. There is none righteous," are mighty rolls of thunder and piercing lightning flashes, and in truth, the very hammer that breaks the rocks in pieces, as Jeremiah calls it in Jeremiah chapter 23 and verse 29, by which everything that exists is shattered, not only in one man or some men or some part of them, but in the whole world and all men without a single exception, so that at these words, the whole world ought to tremble, fear, and take to flight. What stronger or graver terms could have been used than that the whole world is guilty? All the children of men are turned aside and worthless. No one fears God. No one is not wicked. No one understands. No one seeks for God. Nevertheless, such was and is the hardness and insensate obstinacy of our hearts, that we have neither heard nor felt these thunderings and lightnings, but have set up and extolled free choice and its powers in spite of them all, so that we have truly fulfilled the saying in Malachi chapter 1, verse 4, "They build, but I will tear down." The next section, free choice may do the works of the law, but not fulfill the law. In similarly grave terms, this also is said, quote, "No human being will be justified in his sight by works of the law," Romans chapter 3, verse 20. This is strong language, quote, "by works of the law," just as it is also the whole world and all the children of men. For it should be observed that Paul refrains from mentioning persons and speaks of pursuits, which means that he involves all persons and whatever is most excellent in them. For if he had said that the common people of the Jews or the Pharisees or certain ungodly people are not justified, it might have been thought that he had left out some who, by the power of free choice and the help of the law, were not altogether worthless. But when he condemns the works of the law themselves and makes them impious in the sight of God, it is clear that he is condemning all those whose strength lay in their zeal for the law and its works. But it was only the best and noblest that were zealous for the law and its works, and that only with the best and noblest parts of themselves, namely their reason and will. If therefore those who exerted themselves in respect of the law and works with the utmost zeal and endeavor both of reason and will, in other words, with the whole power of free choice, and were assisted besides by the law itself as with divine aid, finding in it instruction and stimulation, if these, I say, are condemned for ungodliness and instead of being justified are declared to be flesh in the sight of God, what is there now left in the whole race of men that is not flesh and not ungodly? For all are alike condemned who rely on the works of the law. For whether they have exercised themselves in the law with the utmost zeal, or with only moderate zeal, or with no zeal at all, does not matter in the least. None of them could do anything but perform works of the law, and works of the law do not justify. And if they do not justify, they prove their doers ungodly and leave them in this condition. And the ungodly are guilty and deserving of the wrath of God. These things are so clear that no one can utter one syllable against them. But they are in the habit of trying to get around Paul here by making out that what he calls works of the law are the ceremonial works, which since the death of Christ are deadly. I replied that this is the ignorant error of Jerome, which in spite of Augustine's strenuous resistance, God having withdrawn and let Satan prevail, has spread out into the world and persisted to the present day. It has consequently become impossible to understand Paul, and the knowledge of Christ has been inevitably obscured. Even if there had never been any other error in the church, this one alone was pestilent and potent enough to make havoc of the gospel. And unless a special sort of grace has intervened, Jerome has merited hell rather than heaven for it. so little would I dare to canonize him or call him a saint. It is, then, not true that Paul is speaking only about ceremonial laws. Otherwise, how can the argument be sustained by which he concludes that all men are wicked and in need of grace? For someone could say, granted, we are not justified by ceremonial works, yet a person might be justified by the moral works of the Decalogue, so that you have not proved by your syllogism that grace is necessary for these. Besides, what is the use of grace that liberates us only from ceremonial works, which are the easiest of all, and which can at the lowest be extorted from us by fear or self-love? It is, of course, also untrue that ceremonial works are deadly and unlawful since the death of Christ. Paul never said that, but he says they do not justify and are of no advantage to man in the sight of God as regards setting him free from ungodliness. Once this is accepted, anyone may do them without doing anything unlawful, just as eating and drinking are works that they do not justify or commend us to God, 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 8. Yet a man does nothing unlawful when he eats and drinks. They are also wrong in that the ceremonial works were as much commanded and required in the Old Law as was the Decalogue, so that the latter was neither more nor less important than the former. And as Paul is speaking primarily to Jews, as he says in Romans chapter 1, verse 16, no one need doubt that by the works of the law he means all the works of the entire law, for it would be meaningless to call them works of the law if the law were abrogated and deadly, since an abrogated law is no longer a law, as Paul very well knew. He is therefore not speaking of an abrogated law when he speaks of the works of the law, but of the law that is valid and authoritative. Otherwise, how easy it would have been for him to say, quote, the law itself now is abrogated. And then we should have had a clear and unambiguous declaration. But let us appeal to Paul himself as his own best interpreter, where he says in Galatians chapter 3, verse 10, quote, all who rely on the works of the law are under a curse, for it is written, cursed be everyone who does not abide by all things written in the book of the law and do them, unquote. You see here, where Paul is making the same point in the same words as in the epistle to the Romans, that every time he mentions the works of the law, he is speaking of all the laws written in the book of the law. And that is more remarkable that he actually quotes Moses, who curses those who do not abide by the law, Deuteronomy chapter 27, verse 26. Although he himself preaches that those are accursed who rely on the works of the law, He thus makes two contrary statements, the one being negative and the other affirmative. He can do this, however, because the fact is that in the sight of God, those who are most devoted to the works of the law are farthest from fulfilling the law because they lack the spirit that is the true fulfiller of the law, and while they may attempt it by their own powers, they achieve nothing. So both statements are true, and both types are accursed. Those who do not abide by the law, as Moses puts it, and those who rely on works of the law, as Paul puts it. For they each lack the Spirit, without whom the works of the law, no matter how much they are done, do not justify, as Paul says in Romans 3:20. And therefore, they do not abide in all the things that are written, as Moses says in Deuteronomy chapter 27, verse 26. In short, Paul's division is confirmation enough of what we teach, for he divides men as doers of the law into two classes, putting those who work according to the Spirit in one and those who work according to the flesh in the other, and leaving none in between. For this is what he says, no flesh will be justified by the works of the law, Romans 3:20. And what else does this mean but that those of whom he is speaking do the works of the law without the Spirit because they are, quote, flesh, or ungodly and ignorant of God, and that these works are of no help to them at all. He draws the same distinction in Galatians chapter 3, verse 2, where he says, did you receive the Spirit by the works of the law, or by hearing with faith? And again in Romans chapter 3, verse 21, but now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law. And again, we hold that a man is justified by faith apart from works of the law, Romans 3:28. From all this, it is unmistakably plain that for Paul, the Spirit is opposed to the works of the law in just the same way as he is to all other unspiritual things, and to the whole gamut of powers and pretensions of the flesh. It is thus clear that Paul takes the same view as Christ, who in John 3:6 says that everything not of the Spirit is of the flesh, no matter how splendid, holy, and exalted it may be, even including the very finest works of God's law, no matter with what powers they are performed. For there is need of the Spirit of Christ, without whom all our works are nothing else than damnable. It can be taken as settled, then, that by the works of the law, Paul means not simply ceremonial works, but all the works of the law in its entirety. With this, it will also be settled that everything connected with the works of the law is condemned if it is without the Spirit. And one of the things without the Spirit is that the very power of free choice. For this is the matter at issue, which is held to be the most outstanding thing a man has. Now nothing more excellent can be said of a man than that he is engaged in works of the law. And Paul is speaking not of those who are engaged in sins and impiety contrary to the law, but these very ones who are engaged in works of the law. That is to say, the best men, the best of men, who are devoted to the law, and who besides the power of free choice have the help of the law itself to instruct and inspire them. If therefore free choice assisted by the law and occupying all its powers with the law is of no avail and does not justify but remains in the ungodliness of the flesh, what may we suppose it is able to do by itself without the law? Quote, through the law, he says, quote, comes knowledge of sin, Romans 3:20. He shows here how much and how far the law helps. In other words, he shows that free choice by itself is so blind that it is not even aware of sin, but has need of the law to teach it. But what effort to get rid of sin will anyone make who is ignorant of sin? Obviously, he will regard what is sin as no sin, and what is no sin as sin. Experience shows this plainly enough by the way of in which the world and the persons of those whom it regards as the best and most devoted to righteousness and godliness hates and persecutes the righteousness of God proclaimed by the gospel, calling it heresy, error, and other abusive names, while advertising its own works and ways, which in truth are sin and error, as righteousness and wisdom. With this text, therefore, Paul stops the mouth of free choice when he teaches that through the law, sin is revealed to it as to someone ignorant of his sin. And that is how far he is from conceding to it any power of striving after the good. Here we also have the answer to that question which Diatribe or Erasmus so often repeats throughout her book. Quote, if we cannot do anything, what is the point of so many laws, so many precepts, so many threatenings and promises? Unquote. Paul here replies, through the law comes knowledge of sin. Unquote. He replies to this question very differently from the way man or free choice thinks. He denies that free choice is proved by the law and cooperates with it to produce righteousness. For what comes through the law is not righteousness, but knowledge of sin. It is the task, function, and effect of the law to be a light to the ignorant and blind, but such a light as reveals sickness, sin, evil, death, hell, the wrath of God, though it affords no help and brings no deliverance from these, but is content to have revealed them. Then, when a man becomes aware of the disease of sin, he is troubled, distressed, even in despair. The law is no help, much less can he help himself. There is need of another light to reveal the remedy. This is the voice of the gospel, revealing Christ as the deliverer from all of these. It is not reason or free choice that reveals Christ. How should it, when it is itself darkness and needs the light of the law to reveal its disease, which by its own light it does not see but believes to be health? So also in Galatians chapter 3, verse 19, dealing with the same question, he says, why then the law? He does not, however, reply as Erasmus and Diatribe does, that it proves the existence of free choice. But he says, it was added, the law was added because of transgressions, till the offspring should come to whom the promise had been made. It was because of transgressions, Paul says, not meaning, however, that it was in order to put a stop to them, as Jerome dreams, since Paul is arguing that a promise had been given to the future offspring that God would take away and put a stop to sins by the gift of righteousness. But it was in order to increase transgressions, as he says in Romans 5:20, quote, law came in to increase sin, unquote. Not that sins were not committed or did not abound without the law, but that they were not known to be transgressions or sins of such grave consequence. On the contrary, most of them, and the greatest of them, were regarded as righteousness. Now, when sins are unrecognized, there is no room for a remedy and no hope of a cure, because men will not submit to the touch of a healer when they imagine themselves well and in no need of a physician. Therefore, the law is necessary to make sin known so that when its gravity and magnitude are recognized, man in his pride, who imagines himself well, may be humbled and may sigh and gasp for the grace that is offered in Christ. Notice how simple the words are. Quote, through the law comes knowledge of sin, yet they alone are powerful enough to confound and overthrow free choice. For if it is true that when left to itself, it does not know what sin and evil are, as he says both here in Romans 7:7, quote, I should not have known that covetousness is sin if the law had not said, you shall not covet. How can it ever know what righteousness and goodness are? And if it does not know what righteousness is, how can it strive toward it? If we are unaware of the sin in which we were born, in which we live, move, and have our being, or rather, which lives, moves, and reigns in us, how shall we be aware of the righteousness that reigns outside of us in heaven? These statements make complete and utter nonsense of that wretched thing, free choice. This being so, Paul speaks with full confidence and authority when he declares, quote, but now the righteousness of God is manifested apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it. The righteousness of God, I say, through faith in Jesus Christ for all and upon all who believe in him. For there is no distinction. Since all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, they are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption which is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as an expiation by his blood, etc. That's Romans 3:21-25. Paul's words here are absolute thunderbolts against free choice. First, the righteousness of God is manifested apart from the law. This distinguishes the righteousness of God from the righteousness of the law. For the righteousness of faith comes from grace apart from the law. The phrase apart from the law cannot mean anything else but that Christian righteousness exists apart from the works of the law in the sense that works of the law are utterly useless and ineffective for obtaining it, as he says immediately below, quote, we hold that man is justified by faith apart from works of the law, Romans chapter 3, verse 28. And as he said above, no human being will be justified in his sight by works of the law, Romans 3:20. From all of which, it is very clearly evident that all the devoted endeavors of free choice are worth absolutely nothing. For if the righteousness of God exists apart from law and the works of the law, must it not much more exist apart from free choice? Especially as the highest aspiration of free choice is to practice moral righteousness or the works of the law with the help afforded by the law to its own blindness and ignorance. This expression, quote, apart from, unquote, excludes morally good works. It excludes moral righteousness. It excludes preparations for grace. In a word, imagine whatever you may as being within the power of free choice, Paul will still persist in saying that the righteousness of God remains, quote, apart from, unquote, that kind of thing. And suppose I allow that free choice can by its own endeavor achieve something, good works, let us say, or the righteousness of the civil and moral law. Yet it does not attain to the righteousness of God, nor does God regard its efforts as in any way qualifying it for his righteousness, since he says that his righteousness functions apart from the law. But if it does not attain to the righteousness of God, what will it gain if by its own works and endeavors, if this were possible, it achieves the very sanctity of angels? The words are not, I think, obscure or ambiguous here, nor is there room for any kind of tropes. For Paul clearly distinguishes the two righteousness, righteousnesses, attributing one to the law and the other to grace, maintaining that the latter is given without the former and apart from its works, while the former without the latter does not justify or count for anything. I should like to see, therefore, how free choice can stand up and defend itself against these things. A second thunderbolt is his saying that the righteousness of God is revealed and avails for all and upon all who believe in Christ, and that there is no distinction, Romans chapter 3, verse 21 and following. Once more, in the plainest terms, he divides the entire race of men into two, giving the righteousness of God to believers and denying it to unbelievers. No one is crazy enough to doubt that the power or endeavor of free choice is something different from faith in Jesus Christ. But Paul denies that everything outside this faith is righteous in the sight of God. And if it is not righteous in the sight of God, it must necessarily be sin. For with God there is nothing intermediate between righteousness and sin, no neutral ground, so to speak, which is neither righteousness nor sin. Otherwise, Paul's whole argument would come to nothing, since it presupposes this division, namely that whatever is done or devised among men is either righteousness or sin before God. Righteousness if faith is present, sin if faith is absent. With men, of course, it is certainly a fact that there are middle and neutral cases where men neither owe one another anything nor do anything for one another. But an ungodly man sins against God, whether he eats or drinks or whatever he does, because he perpetually misuses God's creatures in his impiety and ingratitude, and never for a moment gives glory to God from his heart. It is also no small thunderbolt when he says, "All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God," and, quote, "there is no distinction," Romans chapter 3, verses 22 and 23. I ask you, could he put it more plainly? Show me a worker of free choice and tell me whether in that enterprise of his he also sins. If he does not sin, why does Paul make an exception of him? Why does he include him without distinction? It is certain that no one says all, accepts no one in any place, at any time, in any work or endeavor. Hence, if you accept any man for any kind of effort or work, you make Paul a liar, because the subject of such work and endeavor of free choice is also included in, quote, all. And Paul ought to have had enough respect for him not to place him so freely and without qualification among sinners. Then there is the statement that they lack the glory of God. You can take, quote, the glory of God here in two senses, active and passive. This is an example of Paul's habit of using Hebraisms. Actively, the glory of God is that which God glorifies in us. Passively, it is that which we glory in God. It seems to me, however, that it ought to be taken passively here, like the faith of Christ, which suggests in Latin the faith that Christ has, but to the Hebrew mind means the faith that we have in Christ. Similarly, quote, the righteousness of God in Latin means the righteousness that God possesses, but a Hebrew would understand it as the righteousness that we have from God and in the sight of God. So we take, quote, the glory of God, not in the Latin, but in the Hebrew sense, as that which we have in God and before God, and which might be called glory in God. Now, a man glories in God when he is certain that God is favorable to him and deigns to look kindly upon him, so that the things he does are pleasing in God's sight, or if they are not, they are borne with and pardoned. If then the enterprise or endeavor of free choice is not sin, but good in God's sight, it can certainly glory and say with confidence as it glories, "This pleases God. God approves of this. God counts this worthy and accepts it, or at least bears with it and pardons it. For this is the glory of the faithful in God, and those who do not have it are rather put to shame before him." But Paul here denies this, saying that they are completely devoid of this glory. Experience proves that he is right. For ask all the exercisers of, quote, free choice to man, And if you are able to show me one who can sincerely and honestly say with regard to any effort or endeavor of his own, quote, I know that this pleases God, unquote, then I will admit defeat and yield you the palm. But I know there is not one to be found. Now, if this glory is lacking, so that the conscience dare not say for certain or with confidence that, quote, this pleases God, unquote, then it is certain that it does not please God. For as a man believes, so it is with him. And in this case, he does not believe with certainty that he pleases God, although it is necessary to do so, because the offense of unbelief lies precisely in having doubts about the favor of God, who wishes us to believe with the utmost possible certainty that he is favorable. We thus convict them on the evidence of their own conscience that free choice, when it is devoid of the glory of God, is perpetually guilty of the sin of unbelief, together with all its powers, efforts, and enterprises.